I'm not gonna roll it. Knock yourself out, man.
Could you hum a few bars?
I wish I break free.
Thank you. Thank you for joining.
You're listening to the Signal to Noise podcast on the ProSound Web Podcast Network. Signal to Noise is proudly supported by Audix. Check out the new TM2 integrated acoustic coupler for in-ear monitors and their new line of studio headphones and condenser mics at audixusa.com. Alan and Heath has asked us to read the following statement. Caution. The mixing techniques featured in this episode have been performed by trained survival experts and should not be attempted without adult supervision. You cannot be held responsible for excess 789 Hertz or insufficient 2K in your mix, but we do support you saying, "Kyle made me do it," if anyone asked what happened.
Welcome back to the Signal to Noise podcast. It is 2021. I'm hoping this means a leaf is turned. I'm not 100% positive on that. We'll see what happens.
I'll give it a preemptive golf clap for
2020. Yeah.
Might not be a leaf. Maybe something smaller.
Yes. But what we do have, and as you heard, we have some new sponsors. We have Alan and Heath joining the family here, which is awesome. Jeff Hawley rocks.
What?
Man. we have Audix back with us again as well, so we much appreciate their support. Please check out their stuff. They have great stuff, so this is it's good times.
Jeff would say this is just part of the Matrix, bro.
This or is simulation. Just well, I guess the Matrix is part of the simulation.
It's part of the simulation. This isn't even real.
I mean,
is the simulation that developed where our collective simulation consciousnesses have all decided on who the podcast sponsors are together? That's crazy. I mean, that's like super high level fantasy calculation.
What if
cross correlation?
What if Tony Robbins called us tomorrow and he was like, "I heard about your podcast"? See, that would be weird. What is everybody's New Year's resolution? Did anyone do a New Year's resolution for 2021 since we just got over this thing?
Oh man, I'm gonna go outside more.
My New Year's resolution is to see Kyle and Michael in the same room.
Hey.
In the flesh.
Trade show permitting.
Yeah. I mean, we do have some things coming up that might let this thing happen. I don't know. Let's send it out to the universe like that. Man, that would be really weird to be in the same room.
It would. Well, not for me and you, Kyle, because we've been in the same room before. Yeah, but not with Chris.
I might not be real. You guys have never seen me in person.
What if Chris was catfishing us for 80 episodes? Can you imagine that?
Odd. I'm actually Kyle. He has a voice emulation app that he's actually throwing his voice. Is all this is? I'm not Chris Brian Leonard. I'm actually Kyle Brian. It's anyway.
See.
All right. Well, now that we've wasted 3 minutes of our listeners' time so far, Chris, who's our guest this episode, man?
Yeah, we have Eric Rogers. He's front of house, system tech, 15 plus years or so, working with acts like Godsmack, Avenged Sevenfold, Dustin Lynch, Hunter Hayes, Apocalyptica, Scott Stapp, Ed Kowalczyk. You know, the list just keeps trailing like many others. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, hi there.
Yay. Eric with a K.
Eric with a K, yes.
Which is the cooler way to do it.
It was funny. I hated my name forever because I was like that kid with the weird name, and now it's cool because now I get to correct people and I get to get mad at Starbucks for no reason.
Starbucks does it on purpose.
Phantom of the Opera does it with a K. He's Eric with a K. So I mean, you're in good company, man.
Really?
I think I was the only Kyle back in the 70s too. That was odd, because now when I hear moms yell Kyle, or of course the monster meme Kyle, and South Park.
I was gonna say South Park wrote a song about you.
Ruined it for me, bro. Like, I thought I was like this dude, like nobody has my name, and then all of a sudden it's just a bunch of jerks. So
I went to college with a girl named Kyle.
See, I might be that chick, dude.
I got two catfishes on the show now. Oh dear, what am I gonna do? All right, well, very, very dignified. Welcome to the show, Eric. This is this is about as good as it gets.
That's cool. Sorry. Cool.
Well, we can we could jump right in. So you had an article in ProSound News.
No relation.
You know, we often get tagged in articles from them, but it's all good. So you work with Godsmack. It's 2019. So were you originally the systems tech out on that tour?
I was in 2018. I started off as systems tech on that tour. And beginning 2019, I took over as front of house covering for Scott while he was being sick.
So what was that transition? What was that transition like?
The transition was actually pretty seamless. I had already known the show, and you know, it was like, that's one of those gigs you don't hand off to somebody unless you know and trust them how they're going to do. So it was the only real, I would say, hiccup or anything like that was the first show. Was in London on one day's, which should have been one day's rehearsal, but it was literally one day's emergency build. Oh shit, where is all this? Why the fuck isn't it in the case? Yada, yada, yada. Oh, here's a show. So,
it sounds like every show for Kyle, but anyway.
That's like waking up for me.
Like, I think like about, probably about 26 minutes ago, we got a text from Kyle said, hey, is there a podcast tonight?
Mind you, we record myself every Wednesday night. It's not a new thing.
I know. I was just reminding myself because, you know, it's the new year. I don't know what's going on quite yet. I haven't got my new calendar from Simple Times yet. So, or my dog calendar. No one sent me a calendar.
Do you still use an analog day timer?
Sometimes I use a little Rolodex, the front page of the planner that I got from Office Max or / my iPhone, which I know how to work a little bit of.
When did you retire the sundial? Eric, I'm really interested in that transition that you're talking about. Not in terms of your ability to do the mix necessarily. Obviously you had it under control, but in terms of your mental approach, do you find there's a little bit of mental gear shifting you have to do to get from like system tech mentality into mix mentality? Or is that you kind of okay, you know, on both sides at the same time, or how did that feel for you?
For me, it wasn't an issue, but that's also because as a systems tech, when I was more of a full time systems tech, I was also the part time front of house guy who ended up mixing whatever support band on tour didn't have a band, so I got used to working on however the headline engineer wanted the PA, and then. Later on, I got to work with friends and colleagues that, you know, we really think in alike and work well together. So the only transition was now I got to be my own systems tech, which was pretty rad. Then I got there was no one else to get pissed off at.
Were you pulling double duty on that tour? Were you throwing up the PA, tuning it, and then handed it over to yourself?
On that tour, on the beginning of that tour, no, it was all theaters, so we were using house PA, but I was building my own consoles, tuning the rig in the house and everything like that, but I wasn't deploying it. Later on that year when we went out with Volbeat.
I've heard of those guys.
Yeah, little band. And we
just had Denny Miller on the show a couple episodes ago, actually.
Oh, I just saw Denny at this really cool demo at Meyer in Nashville last month, too.
Well, how was it? Because he invited me, and I obviously couldn't make it out there. I live way up in New York, but I wanted to.
Totally worth the trip. It's some cool stuff. It's some of the coolest stuff Meyer's put out in a bit. It's really cool.
We'll put that on the list of things to investigate here at the Signal Noise Podcast. And also, anyone at Meyer who's listening, I think Mike Armstrong Brown listens to the show. Hook Kyle up with the invite, Mike. He needs it.
Come on.
He needs something to do.
I want to go listen.
So I want to. You had 96 inputs for a 4-piece band.
More than that.
Oh, okay. Well, the article's wrong. Sorry. I missed the over 96. Okay, so let's talk about that. Like, how the hell do you have that many inputs?
There's two drum kits, first of all, it's, you know what, it's. Reasonably speaking, I probably could have done that band on a 48 frame XL4, but I do believe that the inputs expand to fill the available space. It just happens.
They're like goldfish. I always say the same thing. It's as big as you put it in, whatever you got, you're going to find something to do with it, man.
But the reality is if they're going to play it, you should put a microphone on it. And then there's also, it is a big loud rock band. So put things like triggers on every drum to key the gates. It just so happens that the drum kits are massive. And then there's guitars and there's stereo guitars. And then both guys have stereo guitars. And then there's vocal positions all over the stage. And there's, I do count, since all the effects were outboard, those count as an input. They're taking up a hole somewhere. So of course those all have to be stereo coming back, because the very discerning drunken metal fan notices things.
I'm curious about the drums and triggers. Are the triggers only for gates, or are you using like sample kick drums and stuff like that as well?
Nope, only gates. Wow. Only gates. And then in reality, it was funny. I started off heavily relying on that, but as the show developed and I started getting, you know, on my own feet mixing that show, I started my approach a lot differently. By the end of the show, I really wasn't using the gates on anything except the big floor toms off to the side that just rattle, and like the gong drum, but everything else I kind of left open. The gates on the console were good enough just to isolate the drum enough, but let the whole kit breathe.
So, you know, that's an interesting statement, and it's something that I think we've talked about with Ryan John. I think it's been two or three episodes since we name dropped Ryan John on the show. So there's your drop for the month of January. Hi, Ryan.
Checks in the mail.
When I first met Ryan, I walked up to him at front of house. I think he was doing Philip Phillips at the time, and we were talking, and he said something like, "Oh yeah, I don't use graphic EQs," and it exploded my brain, because the fact that you could just decide to not use a certain thing that you didn't like to use. And I was like, wow, there are no rules. This is amazing. So I always feel a little bit ashamed of my lack of gates. I don't like gates. I don't like the way they sound with the bleed. And so I have I absorb a very uneasy truce with gates, and I use them very sparingly. So I feel a little kinship with you now that you're like, you know, I don't need to gate everything. I that's cool, man. I dig that. I'm glad you're not afraid to buck the convention.
Yeah. It's funny. We're all a product of what we've learned over the years. So at some point I learned this trick, and I'll admit it. I learned it by watching Big Mick, and let's put a trigger on every drum, and that keys the gates. And then that's how you get that big fat drum sound. And it's really cool, but it's not that one piece of gear is not how you get Lars's kit to sound like Lars's kit. At some point you have to be Big Mick and do all those things and be that. And then at some point you start to realize that it's not just the tools, it's not just the technology, but you're actually listening. You have this relationship with the band on stage, with the player, with the music that's coming out. And it doesn't always make sense to do what somebody else did or what you knew how to do. You actually have to stop and think and realize that all this technology and all these amazing tools that we have in front of us are just to make what's coming off the stage come out of the speakers and sound like it's supposed to sound.
Man, that's awesome. When I edit this, I'm going to copy and paste that statement and repeat it so people can really, really take it. I mean, here's the thing. It's so crazy to me. And part of this, there's a whole culture that's grown up in the music community around, well, I need to get the mic that John Lennon used to do this because I want that sound. And I need the, you know, I mean, it gets so silly, like the Hendrix signature distortion pedal. He didn't use the Hendrix signature distortion pedal. You know what I mean? So we pay so much attention to everything in the signal chain, and there's all these forum posts about, hey, what mics did they use to get this drum sound? Like, but we forget about the drummer and you know, the instrument. And I think there's such a blind spot there for a lot of people. I'll never forget, I was at front of house a couple of years ago on the Frampton tour, and I was watching Jimmy Jakubowski do his line check for Frampton, and the drum tech hits the snare drum, and I said, Jim, that snare drum, said your snare drum sounds awesome. And he goes, yeah, it's a nice drum. And then he kind of and I was like, yeah, that's it. You know, we think so much about, oh man, well, Mike, let me see your EQ on that. I'm like, no, it's a nice drum.
Well, that goes back to
Chris Mitchell. Yeah.
Chris Mitchell. So he doesn't change the microphone. He changes the snare. They have multiple snares and they pick the snare for the day that works the best for the day for Umphys McGee. I mean, how crazy is that?
I love it.
It's brilliant.
I love it. Yeah. And it's, I mean, so I'm so glad you said that, Eric. And for all the, I know all the students listening here who are all into the gearhead stuff. I mean, that's all awesome and it's cool, but don't forget, I mean, the best way to get, you know, the Led Zeppelin drum sound is to have John Bonham and John Bonham's drum set, you know? Yeah, exactly. So I think let's not turn a blind eye to the actual, you know, source itself.
But don't pay attention to the gear is just a tool. It's like, did you build a better shelf because you had the fancy hammer, or is it the craftsman behind the hammer? You know, it's just the tools just get you there. Just listen to it. And if it sounds good, it's right.
There you go.
Was that your first time mixing dueling drummers?
Was it my first time mixing dueling drummers? Yeah, I think it was actually.
Was there anything different about that other than just more drums? I mean, like, was there, what kind of, I imagine it's got to be a little bit different art approach to mixing two drums as opposed to drummer as opposed to one.
Well, the interesting thing is they're two very different drummers. So it wasn't so much dueling drummers as it was mixing two different players, two different styles. Now there's a part of that whole bit where they're playing in unison. And the only thing, there's if and when the very rare occurrence that they came exactly on the same impulse of the kick drum, I had it happen a couple times where I had the kick drum cancel each other out. And that was weird. And that was as simple as reverse polarity on one kit to the other. But outside of that, it was just carving space in the PA for them. But since there was no vocal mic, there's nothing else I had to get out on the top. All the vocals were dead. It's just bass, guitar, and drums, and they're all kind of fitting in their own little thing. It was just kind of a rhythm.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think that's, you know, that says a lot, and it's similar to my previous comment, but it's something that I've really come to believe in more and more as I, you know, continue to work with the groups that now I've been working with for longer periods of time. When you're doing a one-off, you get what you get, but so much of this is like, hey, if you manage your own dynamics better as players, then I don't have to do that much out front, you know? And so you peel back this layer of, okay, well now I'm not busy flying to try to balance out the guitars the whole show. So that allows me to go and do this other cool thing that refines the mix in a different way. And it's really about finding how those parts naturally want to fit together and give them space to do that. And I think oftentimes you can really get yourself into some knots trying to kind of shoehorn things in where they just musically don't want to go, you know?
Well, I'm a big fan of letting whatever is happening on stage happen. And instead of focusing on maybe there's a dynamic part of the drum solo that it gets really, really quiet. It's kind of supposed to be. And I think I heard Pooch say this when he was describing, forgive me if I'm wrong, Pooch, but I think he was talking about a Linkin Park mix he did a long time ago where there was a part of the show where the audience was straining to hear the PA. And he was like, it's a quiet part of the song. It's supposed to be your song. You know? And that was just one of those things that stuck out to me over the years. I'm like, it's supposed to be. So there is a part in the dual drum solo thing where it's rim shots and sticks. Now I could, you know, bring the noise floor up and make it stupid loud and, you know, everything on the brink of whatever, or we could let it sound like it would sound if you were just standing on stage and right before he was beating the shit out of a drum kit and now he's tapping the sticks together over his head. It's going to sound a little bit different. It's going to have a different life. And I'm a really big proponent of let that happen.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's dynamics. It's a lot of my work that I've been working on in the last year or so is about, you know, working with front of house engineers in terms of SPL type stuff. And so how do you mix in a way that is dynamic and is impactful and deliver a show that has that? When you know how to use other tools than just, you know, set SPL level to stun and let it go. And so, you know, that use of dynamics either by the musicians naturally, or if we're accenting that and sort of enhancing it in our mix, I mean, that's such a powerful thing in terms of the listening experience. And the more I dug into playing with metering and playing with, you know, keeping an eye on all of these different dynamics passages through as the show goes on, I mean, it really, really calls into light for me, like how important dynamics really are. And I think that's another thing that's kind of overlooked. People are like, this is my cruising speed SPL, and I'm going to sit here. I'm like, well, what if there's a quiet song? When you know, it's okay.
Well, and Chris, what happens when you start off, you know, on stun, and exactly. 2 hours later, you're fried.
Yeah, where do you go?
Well, and speaking of that, you exactly. You talked about how your mixing philosophy has to change, and this played into actually what just Michael was talking about, of how you had to kind of walk your SPL down throughout this tour. Can you talk about what that was like and what you experienced through that time?
It was fun because I inherited a loud show. I really did, and they were used to being loud, and then we got to Europe, and you're not allowed to be loud. And it wasn't really a struggle. It was the perception. If your mix is good, in headphones, your mix is good in local monitors, and it's good in the PA, then it's just stupid loud in the PA. And of course, when you turn it down, you're not going to feel it. It's not going to have that bump. It's not going to shake your ass like it did in the American theater where you were just punishing everybody. But the more I got into the habit of doing that, then we got back into the States, and now in the US, it's my first day back. I remember we were in Nashville, and I'm giddy. I'm happy. I'm like, fuck yeah. Open the throttle up and here we go. And then Volbeat came out, and Mads had Volbeat right around 100, and it sounded spectacular. There was no reason for me to be that much louder than him, except I could be. I just brought it back, and I start to notice there's less fatigue. The audience, there's no perceptible difference. The audience had a good time. So it's just get your mix right and kind of just resist the urge to have all the lights on the console on.
What did you find yourself having to do to make sure that the perception was there? Like what changes to make the perception there, but not actually just be brute force?
Clarity. It's like you have to be. When it's crazy loud, and I mean, I've heard some really loud shows before, and there's a perception that loud is good. So when it's quiet, when it's loud and maybe not good, it doesn't matter. They felt the music and they could kind of understand their favorite song and people are happy. And then you turn it down and then you start to realize there's things missing that you're not noticing before because it's just this massive kick drum and this guitar that sounds like a chainsaw and you could hear the words and it's great. And then you turn it down and you start to realize all the nuance of things that people are playing were missing in your mix, but you didn't know it because you were just being punished. Mm-hmm. So the perception of loud to me is full. And if you have a nice full mix, then the people are going to be happy. If you have a hollow mix, an empty mix, or something's wrong and it's just quiet, then it's just quiet and wrong.
I think Drew Thornton said when we had him on the show, he said, use all the frequencies. And I like the way you said that, you know, yeah. Like you said, just have a full spectrum and that really goes a long way.
Absolutely. Use all the frequencies. I'm a big believer of if there's something on stage being played, put it in the mix. If there's somebody singing into a microphone, put it in the mix and put it in the mix the way you would perceive it as you're looking at the band. I mean, there's nothing. We shouldn't, and this is me, I don't want to be preachy, but I don't think we should be recreating the wheel that's not ours to recreate.
Yeah, that's very valid.
That too.
Yeah, so I'm curious, what was there any interaction with the band in terms of what they were used to level-wise? I mean, they had to have noticed a walk down. How did that go?
There's a couple funny moments about that, we were in one of the little places in Germany, and you know those clubs where when you're doing a European club and theater tour, you can play places that hold 5,000 people and you can hold places that hold 50. And we go into this place and it's pretty tiny. I think the stage was 24 wide by 20 deep. And I had been working with the backline guys to get the stage volume down, because that was the biggest problem, is these guys they're a rock band and they want to feel it. And no matter what the problem was, if the guitar amps on stage are louder than the house PA, there's nothing you can do about it. And I had been working together with them and like, let's get this down. And finally, one day, Sully walks on stage and we all did virtual, so we're all line checked, ready to go. If he wants to rehearse, he can rehearse. And he plays it, and he's like, "What is this?" And he walks back to his guitar tech, makes him turn everything all the way to the right, and looks at me and goes, "We're a rock band. It's your job to make it work." and he's not wrong. It's we're a rock band. Make it work. So and there's things like that. Like you have to delicately walk around that. You know, you want to make sure the artist is happy on stage. And if the artist can't feel what he's playing or do what he's used to doing, then he's not going to be happy. And then that's not going to be a good show. So that was the biggest struggle, was dealing with places that had kind of, I would say, absurd rules. I understand their safety. I get it. But if I can't get the vocal through the PA louder than the guitar cabinets, we're going to have a problem. So that was it. That was the only thing. It was just working together with the backline and working together with the band to actually make something, you know, doable.
Did your knowledge and background as a systems engineer, does that play into anything you're doing when you found yourself mixing front of house in terms of PA design or how you wanted to deploy your subs for, you know, the experience that the artists are looking for on stage? I mean, did you leverage any of that to help your mix?
I absolutely did. And it's interesting because as a systems engineer, you go out and you take care of your headline engineer. And I'm a very different engineer than Scott is. So I did. I changed sub deployment. I changed a lot of things. And I remember we were in Las Vegas, and there was another one of those incidents where, you know, it's a common thing to have, you know, left right subs or some more of a traditional sub deployment. And I'm not about that. I'm all about flown. I want nothing on the floor. And Sully comes out and he's like, "Where are the subs?" And I'm like, "Up there." They're there. Don't worry. It's all good. And it's one of those things where it's my playground now. I get to do it how I want to do it. It didn't change the audience experience at all. It was just more comfortable for me to mix in how my style. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly appreciate that. It was an interesting, it's always interesting to hear, you know, the more holistic approach, where I think, you know, a lot of people I've worked with who are mix engineers, they're sort of like, okay, I'm going to go to my console and do what I do. And, you know, the PA is, you know, a besides being a literal black box, it's a, you know, a metaphorical black box to them. But, and then the more holistic approach saying, well, I know my artist has certain expectations for how they want it to be on stage. And with some artists, that's, they want a lot of subwash. Some artists don't want any subwash. You know, how about the mono engineer? And I found it, you know, the earlier I can start building those things into the show, even if I'm the front house engineer, you know, everything else gets easier if you've sort of stacked the deck in your favor, you know.
But see, the monitor engineer thing is an interesting thing. I remember this was years and years ago, the first time I started deploying a cardioid subarray, and the monitor guy walks in and he sees subs pointing at him, and there's no amount of convincing. Like, he's already convinced that he's fucked for the night. So it was, you have to do playback. You have to, you know, play some music and walk them around. And then even after you demonstrate, like, look, it's 6 dB quieter back here at your desk. But now it's weird because now he's not hearing something that he's used to be hearing. So it's still wrong. So he was mad that he thought it was going to be worse, but now it's better, but now he's still mad.
That's great. I remember, I think I was probably 20 years old. It was one of my first festivals I ever worked on, like, you know, in any capacity where I was interfacing with visiting techs. And the support act, they were like a B-level touring act, and their engineer had never seen a cardioid subarray before, which is kind of weird because this was like, you know, 2009. So they were definitely a thing in 2009, yeah. but he's like, "Hey, I don't know what's going on with your stuff." He was like politely trying to find out if the local system tech was an idiot or not, is what, because if you don't know what a cardioid subarray is, it looks like you don't know what you're doing.
Weird.
Right. So I said, "Oh yeah, come here." And I walked him around, and he was like, "Huh, well, that's really something." And I always thought that was a funny, moment, you know, that I was this pipsqueak kid who had no idea, zero experience. And, you know, this tech who'd been, I mean, he was working for some pretty big bands at the time. And I was like, you know what? You never know what you're going to run into, I guess. So that was a funny moment. And I also really like the takeaway from that, which is like, hey, you never know. You might learn something today. You know, there's, I really like that environment where you show up to a gig and you go home and you know, he taught me some stuff. And that was cool because I was mixing one of the openers and he's standing there. He's, you know, waiting for me to finish so we can talk. And I said, hey, do you think I'm overcompressing my bass? And he said, oh, yeah, you are. Here, watch this. And puts on my cans and puts a couple of EQ cuts in there. And I love how quickly he jumped into that because he had already decided that I was overcompressing my bass and didn't say anything to me. And as soon as I asked, he had the answer ready. And so, like, the moral of the story is we both went home from that show and we both learned some stuff. And I just thought that was really cool. So I think about that a lot. You know, the guy who had never seen the Cardioid sub before.
See, I'm the opposite. When I was fortunate when I was young and getting started in this, the guy I worked for, we just would set up in our shop doing crazy mad scientist nerd experience with all kinds of sub deployment. And it was EVMT fours. And it was in the basement of this warehouse. I'm sure we were pissing off everybody who was upstairs from us. But then, so here I am, I'm like the 22-year-old kid coming in and we bring PA for the local venue and whoever the touring engineer comes in. And I've got this perfectly tuned Cardioid subarray. And he's like, fuck is this? And you know, he's a seasoned veteran. And here I am just this punk kid. I'm barely old enough to have the beer in my hand, schooling him on Cardioid subs. And the experience I have with, he's like, yeah, you know what? That is better. And I still don't like it. So change it back. Yes, sir. My pleasure.
I love that though. Like, hey, I'm going to go down to the shop and just do this and see what happens. And I think, you know, especially now, I definitely encourage people to, that hands-on time is so, so important. And I said earlier that my project for quarantine was to get better at mixing. And so I spent, you know, every time I get an F spare hour, I just grab some multi-tracks and fire them through a desk and see what you'd come up with. But for those listeners who are interested in the systems engineering side of things or just kind of broadening your horizons as a mix engineer, go and see if you can, you know, tune a Cardioid array in your parking lot or see what happens if you can, you know, set a delay time on a fill speaker by ear. And that stuff's really, really good to do. And it's something you can easily do in a spare hour or so. So I just want to encourage everyone to don't be scared of that stuff. It's good for you.
I really do believe that, like, we've had a year of opportunity. And if you're coming back, I mean, we are going to be going back to work at some point, maybe 2027. I don't fucking know. But eventually we're going back to work and you've had a lot of time to learn, to read, to listen, to do anything. And if you haven't get started now. I guarantee you there's no sound company out there right now that would say, no, you can't come in and learn. Like, just go do something, figure it out.
Yeah. And I, you know what, and shout out to my buddies, Nate and Ryan, who I did two years ago, I did a Reddit post and I just said, hey, I'm going to be at this venue. I'm going to be doing the show. If anyone wants to come chat with me, feel free. And these two guys drove like 90 minutes each to come and just, you know, hang out, watch me move a mic around the venue for an hour. And they, you know what, they showed up super enthusiastic, a lot of great questions, really, really cool people, both of them. And they both got job offers out of it. So they both are on our crew call list now. So, you know, that stuff is, you know, like you said, what else we got going on? I mean, jump in and take advantage of that time. It's really valuable stuff.
Yeah, Kyle.
Yeah, Kyle. Where is Kyle? I haven't seen his.
I'm right here. I'm listening intently.
He's squinting and rubbing his chin and just
nodding my head.
Yeah, he's just focusing very intently on the conversation. I'm sure you have some thoughts, though, Kyle. Fire away, man.
Well, I've definitely done my fair share of Godsmack shows. So, and actually one of my system techs for a long time was their monitor engineer before he came over to work for us. And he said they could either be the coolest guys or the roughest guys. And he said, like, sometimes Kyle. There was, and well, I mean, the dude got like a Harley Davidson for their album. Like the first album that came out, like, they bought everybody on the crew motorcycles. So that's dope. Like, you don't hear about that kind of stuff. Like, it seems like Godsmack super takes care of their people.
They take very good care of us, and they treat everybody like family. They really do. And let me say that they treat everybody like family from Massachusetts. So
it's different.
Growing up in Ohio, it was a little much to take it. I mean, you don't know if, when you're getting yelled at, if it's out of love or hate, because it all sounds the same. But
that's the way Kyle talks to us.
But the truth is, I would say they're all great guys. Like, especially when we're overseas, we band together, and it becomes one of those things where they were right there in the dirt with us. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
I had a buddy go to Godsmack show a couple years ago, and he came back from the show and he said that was the best show I've ever seen. So for sample size of one, it's apparently a really good show too.
It is a good show.
I've known Eric for a while now. We've known each other probably about what, like 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, at least.
At least. And I wanted you to talk about the Hello TV thing.
I want to talk about the Hello TV thing, as a matter of
fact. Well, let's get to it, my man, because the last time we talked, you were super stoked about it. Then you got super busy because there was only like three of you working on this massive project that I heard turned out amazing. So fill the people in.
And I apologize for not mentioning that in the intro, but we'll make up for it now.
That's okay. I mean, I am so happy to talk about anything. It's cool. And what's funny, I've been talking about Hello all year long, so remembering what it was like to mix a rock show in front of people felt good. Hello TV started. Paris Fasoni, who is the photographer and videographer for Godsmack, and we got to talking right around NAMM of this year of what are we doing this year? And we started talking about where's going out. And I know that Scotty had come back and he was mixing Godsmack, and I had gone and started talking with other artists to go out and mix other things. And so we were just kind of, we kept in touch, and then this pandemic thing happened. I'm not even bullshitting. We were playing Call of Duty one night at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Sweet.
And it was
me, bro.
It was right after that first real big televised benefit concert. Lady Gaga did it. We watched Elton John play a song in his driveway under his basketball goal.
I remember the
Stones play air drums in the living room. And we're playing Call of Duty. We're killing terrorists, whatever. And I said, did you see that Lady Gaga thing? And she's like, no, what's about? I'm like, I don't know, but we could do better. And like a month later, we have a company and we're setting up a studio in Nashville to do videos. But it literally started off of me just kind of rolling my eyes, going, man, like the people that we look up to, the people that the reasons we got into this business are, I mean, no disrespect intended, but at the very beginning, they were kind of phoning it in with a GoPro, and they didn't know what they were. They didn't know how to connect with an audience. And that's what we did. We put together a platform for an artist to connect with an audience that's not in that sterile iMag, you know, mechanically filmed kind of way. We do, it's all organic. We have humans with cameras. We shoot wide. We shoot at 24 frames per second. I mix the shows in Clang, so it's immersive, which is really, really cool. And it's that we position the whole show like it's from the perspective of that. You're that kid smashed up against the barricade. You're in that second person point of view. It's really, really cool.
And your first show, was it at the Ryland or Auditorium?
No, all of our shows, like the first, we'll call it first season. So the first 10 were at Soundcheck in Nashville. Ben Jumper was very kind and gave us room F at Soundcheck for all of June, May and June. And artists started actually paying for the room, so we had to move. And have a long relationship with Special Event Services, and Michael Brammer basically opened his warehouse and gave me a key, and all of the rest of our shows have been filmed there.
Talk about the Clang. So do people need to wear headphones to truly experience that, or how does that translate?
Yes and no. I will preface this by saying I'm going to have a Clang in my front of house rack from now on. Clang, the when I called Matt Larson from Digico to help me with a console for Hello TV, I totally did not expect to get a Quantum 7. And I did. And through Claire, actually, through Scooter and Sean Claire, I ended up getting a Quantum 7. And the only caveat was Digico wanted me to have a Clang. So we have an SD10 at monitors and the Quantum 7 at front of house broadcast. And I believe Matt actually thought that I was going to have Mike Babcock, our monitor guy, dial in a Clang mix for whatever, however many musicians every day for a new band. And he was immediately like, nope, not going to do that. So I'm like, okay, let me see what I can do with this. And I got to thinking, well, if people are going to watch on their laptops, if we just flash up the little logo with the headphones and the Clang thing, it's like for immersive sound, pop in your headphones. Let's see what happens. And I talked to Phil Camp at Clang, asked him, do you think it will translate over broadcast? And he pointed out that you can hear it on their YouTube demo. I'm like, well, shit, we're streaming on YouTube, so obviously it'll work. And that's how I set up the mix. The mix is 100% built for a headphone mix. But when you take your headphones off and I'm listening to my monitors in the studio, there's a width. And the best way I could describe it is if you're a Waves user and you've ever used Vitamin, it's Vitamin, but good. there's a width and a depth that's defined by the Clang that's not there. And every artist that's come to the studio, I bring them in, and it's kind of the same process because they want to hear it because they don't see me at all. I mean, I'm in a completely different room, and it's a trust factor. The artist's like, oh, are we going to sound good? Of course you are. And then they want to come back in and listen to it. And the first thing that I let them listen to the show, however it was. And they're always like, wow, that's really great. Like, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Hey, check this out. And I give them the headphones. And the first thing I do is I click the tab on the screen that collapses it just into a stereo left, right mix. And they're listening to it. I'm like, yeah, that's rocking. That's pretty good. And then, you know, I always try to build it like right at the verse chorus of a song. And then I pop it into the immersive mix, into the Clang, and expand it around their headspace. And every single one of them takes a step back and their eyes get huge. So I learned that we were onto something really quick with the immersive mixing. And then when it translates into the near field, you can do the same thing. You collapse it down into a stereo mix in your near field monitors. And it sounds like a nice clean stereo mix. But as soon as you put that immersive 3D, whatever magic wizardry that Clang has going on in there, you can't perceive the height. You can't perceive the elevation, but you can definitely perceive the width. And then panning inside of Clang is fractions of a fraction. It's so precise. I can't sing the praises of it enough.
Are you mixing in real time to like a two track, or are you doing some post work with it in terms of your mix?
Both. The show is 100% live mixed to a two track, but it is also 100% multi-tracked redundantly. So on the A engine and the B engine of the Quantum 7, I'm recording all 56 channels. So I think every show I'm taking up close to 100 gig.
And because because I'm not familiar enough with the Clang stuff, even though we've actually talked about it on here, is there a typical stereo element to it, and you're doing a separate Clang mix? Or are you mixing all within Clang, and then you pop on headphones to do the more spatial stuff, and then you do traditional left right off your near fields?
All right, here I think it might be easier if I can just go through my signal workflow. Where,
yeah, baby.
straight off of the SD rack is redundant multi-track. So I always have that. I can always do a virtual playback mix. But within the console, so 56 channels come in, and I have a MADI stream that goes out to Clang. The way I send that MADI stream out to Clang, though, is through stems. You can do it through MADI, so I could get 56 channels into Clang, but that would be a hot mess, I think. So I send some stems and some individual channels. Like, I send drums as a stem. I send bass, whatever it is, as a mono stem. So you have bass mic, bass DI, and bass synth or whatever, I send that as a mono stem. I send guitars. If it is a mono guitar, I send a mono stem. If I'm putting, say, my AT2500 on the guitar, so I have that, you know, cool blend of dynamic and condenser, then I send that as a stereo send, and I kind of 10 and 2 the signal into that subgroup just to get that into clang. So, because what happens is the way the clang does the spatial things is they do these like minute changes using EQ and delay. So if you take a mono signal and you make it stereo, it gets super thin. So you just got to keep in mind of what you're putting into clang. Clang is going to manipulate in a way to make it perceive like it's someplace else. That comes out of the clang and back into the console. And that, how does that work on the quantum? Okay. All the stems go out to the clang. They come back in, subbed into the mix bus, and the mix bus goes out to Logic.
There you go. You got it, Chris.
Why did you say?
I'll also mention, and we said this, we had I think it was Becky Pell on the show, yeah. And she's a big proponent of the clang system as well. You can download their app and you can plug headphones in, and you don't need the hardware to try the demo on the app. So if you have an iPad, or I think it runs on computer too, it's really, really cool. And you can play with it. You don't need to hook anything up to it. And so you can really understand how it works. And I mean, I'll definitely agree with what you said, Eric. I mean, there's really no way to describe it until you've heard it. And then all of a sudden when you go back to stereo mode, you're like, ah, like it's deflating. It's really, really cool. And it's definitely worth experiencing and playing around with. So I'll encourage everybody to go download that app and play with it.
I'm really looking forward to seeing what it does through a PA. Like I know that I'm not going to be able to do the minutia of spatial deployment like I can with headphones, but I'm telling you, there's something about the width and the spacing and the panning that you just can't get anywhere else.
Is it, how do I put this? How easy will it be for someone, or how often will somebody basically just make shit out of it? You know, like, I don't...
You guys have a potential for abuse, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you know what? You're onto something there, because it would be very easy for someone to make shit out of it. It's not something that I would ever say throw on a festival or a one-off. It's something that you need to build in rehearsals and think about. Like, I built a template. I have a different band every day, and I built kind of a template where I know where the drums are going to be. I know where the bass is going to be, and the guitars are kind of in space as they would be on stage. So the only thing that really changes is when, say, a band brings in a dobro and a fiddle and some other stuff that I don't have a preset for, but that's maybe 3, 4, 5 things. But if you had to do a whole band, forget about it.
So when you're mixing this, are you going back and forth between cans and your near fields? Or, you know, when you're in the moment mixing this, how are you going about that?
The way we do the show is we actually ask the band to do a full show rehearsal, and the full show rehearsal is for all of us. It's for me, it's for our camera crew, and for the lighting guy, so we can all do a flawless show, because we try to record the show straight through and do no edits. We don't do any punches. We don't do any like cuts. So if the artist messes up or they want to do a retake, they do redo the whole song. So the rehearsal, I do 100% in my headphones. And that's where I do all the spacing out and clang, and I take care of the mix there. So by the time the show happens, I can take the headphones off and I mix in near fields.
That's pretty cool. I can't wait to actually check it out and kind of experience the difference between listening to it, just say, you know, on my computer speakers versus, you know, the headphones, and kind of hear the difference. So I think it's going to be cool to try out.
It is, as audio technology goes, you know, you guys know I don't get super excited on like the brand new flash in the pan technology stuff, but this clang is really, really cool. it's really neat. And I, again, if you haven't messed around with it and experienced it, you really should. It's really something special.
I'm curious, going back to some of your other work. So you've done a lot of metal and rock, but you also have some country in there with Dustin Lynch and Hunter Hayes. One thing I've noticed through the years, or at least in the last decade or so, is that modern country is basically a rock show with Little Twang.
100%.
Like church.
I'm just curious though, like, what do you find different about how you're treating the two, and was there any learning curves between the two? Like, going from Avenged Sevenfold to Hunter Hayes, that's slightly different. Okay, maybe majorly different, but in some ways, it's still, that Hunter Hayes show. I mean, I guarantee you, you're still a kick drum pounding you in the chest.
There's still a kick drum pounding you in the chest, and then there's a virtuoso kid that can play every instrument and stand in front of the PA and like dissect your mix. So that was more of the challenge is dealing with, I wouldn't say dealing is the wrong word, of working with somebody like Hunter, who is unbelievably talented. Not that anybody else I've worked with isn't, but Hunter is that guy. He knows what he wants. He knows his music inside and out. He knows exactly what it's supposed to sound like. That's the difference. It's not, is it big metal kick drum and grindy guitars, or is it, band buried underneath the country vocal? It's more like, does this sound like my record?
You know what? And I see the appeal of working with an artist who, says the typical, hey, just go make me sound good. But I've really come to appreciate working with an artist who knows exactly what they want. And it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it, I found in a lot of cases. And I appreciate that,
But for the country thing, I was told anyway, and I mean, we're going back to what, 2015, but I was told that I was hired for Dustin Lynch specifically because he was looking for somebody with a rock and roll background. So I get out.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I get out there, and I didn't know who Dustin Lynch was. I had no idea. My first show was a county fair, I believe, in St. Louis or Kansas City. It's one of those places on the river that I don't remember all the time.
One of those hee-haw places.
One of them hee-haw places, and it was a prelude because the next day was Oklahoma City in the arena opening up for Luke Bryan. And I go in there and it was Luke and Randy Houser and Dustin, and we went first. So I had no perception, and it was an ongoing tour. So I was the new guy walking in on a well-oiled machine. So I had no perception of what I was walking into at all. And Frank Scambalone, who's now front of house for Luke, was the SE for Luke at the time. And I looked, I'm like, I don't know what to do. He's like, mix your band, dude. that's all he is. Like, just mix your band. I'm like, oh, all right. And I did my thing, and I come out, and of course I'm the new kid and management's there, and it was exactly what they wanted, probably just a little too loud. and it was, I mean, country crowd is a little quieter, and the only difference is they were happy with everything, and he just wanted his vocal just a little more on top than, like my kind of approach to a rock and roll mix is everything is kind of in your face. In country makes little sense. Like if your name's on the ticket, the name should be a little louder than everything else.
I mentioned that goes for most front men, but yeah. I'm also curious on Apocalyptica working with strings.
Oh, the best. Oh,
so yeah, can you talk about what was is it any mics or is it all DI like pickups? I mean, and both. What was that like trying to mix that in and getting that dynamic level up with a metal sound?
Both. There's actually three inputs per cello. There were pickups, there were mics, and then there was also DIs going out through, at the time it was PV6505s. And I believe that they've grown their Kemper now, which is a lot easier to control. But at the time, it wasn't. So there were three inputs per cello plus the drums. Pavo, he's the bass cello player. He had this subharmonic octavizer pedal thing that just made the brown note. It was just this ridiculously low frequencies that I've never heard, and it was these monstrous sounds that you can't even describe what they sound like. They're just coming, they're just screeching out of a PA or rumbling out of a PA. We used to carry carpet squares all over the stage, and you just tape these little squares, like 3-inch squares of carpet down, and that's where they could put the peg for their cello.
Oh, that's funny.
Did you have to learn, or not learn, I should say, I know some of the first times that I started doing some violins live, I got told by a violinist, she was like, make it sound less like a violin. She was like, I guess I had it like too clean and too, like, you know, maybe cut through. And again, it wasn't a rock and metal thing. In fact, it was on Groban. But it was like, it was a learning curve, I guess, and maybe what the experience to be versus maybe what you expected it to be. Like, was that your first experience with strings?
It was my first experience with strings. It's weird. Most of the bands I've been with, I haven't heard before I started mixing them. It just got lucky that way, or unlucky, depends. I didn't know what to expect. And I come out there, and it was these guys that are trained cellists that also happen to have long hair and love Metallica. And they were the same way. They were like, this is not a cello show. This is a rock show. And then I start to hear this distorted sound coming that sounds kind of like a guitar, like electric guitar, and kind of like a cello. And I would say, like, the only approach I could think of outside of, you know, EQing things so it sounded smooth was high and low pass filters. Like the subs on those PAs were low pass at 50, and depending on, like, every cello kind of has its place. There's like the lead, the rhythm, and the bass, and you high pass accordingly to leave room for all these things. So if somebody's playing the same note, you have the same, all three guys playing the same note, but you have the speakers and the PA system playing for the right guy.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to the fundamentals of mixing, right? Like making space for the, you know, everything else that's out there. Right. I mean, you know, there's only so many frequencies, and not everyone can occupy all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The cool thing is there was no vocal mics to deal with except for like three songs a night. So it was really a good opportunity. There's nothing open that just sits there and picks up all the stage bleed. It was actually, I would say, easier than some rock and roll stuff I've done because of that.
That's cool. All right. So here's a new question that I'm going to ask everyone in 21. Well, maybe, but what?
This is the new 22. Is this, we're not replacing the food question, are we?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Shit. We haven't.
We got to keep that one.
Okay. We'll go there. Before we go there, and we're running a little long, I don't care, you know, whatever. Maybe there's something you haven't thought about. So, if you could be known for something in your career, like you're done your career, or somewhere you're trying to go, what do you want your legacy to be?
What do I want my legacy to be?
If you even care about that. But
damn, you got to go home and think about that and come back on the show next week. That's a heavy question, Chris.
That's heavy as shit. Like, what am I saying, bro?
But I like that in the moment. I want you to come up with an answer, though. What, if you had to pick, what
2021 Signal Noise Podcast gets serious.
Yeah. No, I can answer that. What do I want my legacy to be? I want my legacy to be that I was positive to work with, and it was a good experience to work with me, and I changed the industry for the better. If you want to hear my legacy, there's plenty of YouTube videos of shows that I've done great and plenty of YouTube videos of shows that I've fucked up. But
YouTube audio is so convincing too, bro.
I know, right? But I would rather walk away from this, whether it's whether a virus kills our careers forever today or we've got 20 more years, I would rather walk away with people just remembering that I was good to work with and that I contributed something positive to this industry.
Well, Chris, was that everything you hoped for, man?
Absolutely, yeah. Mic drop there, yeah, absolutely.
I'd stop the whole world from mixing their subs on the aux. Like, if I could, if people could stop mixing their subs on an aux, that'd be great.
Hear, hear. I agree with that too.
All right. Well, come on. We can't kick off 21 without talking about food. So, Eric, touring the world, where's your favorite place to eat?
Touring the world, where's my favorite place to eat? New York City.
Okay.
The whole city.
Okay. Go further. Let's narrow it down a little bit further than that.
Okay. Let's see. Last year we found this ridiculously good dessert restaurant in Chinatown that was like this combination of bubble tea and ice cream and brownie that was just, it was ungodly ridiculously good. Outside of that, if I have to go outside the country, I would probably have to say Mexico City.
Respectable. We'll allow it.
I mean, you know, it's close to the, you know, the taco world of Signals to Noise. So yeah, it fits. Well, you get a pass.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right.
Eric, thank you for your time. I you know, I've kind of been keeping up with you through friends of friends. So it's nice to hear from you, you know, face to face as it were, and have you chat with us. It's been a cool time. So thank you. Thank you for your time, man.
Oh no, thank you. I've seen all my friends, and listened to all my friends doing your show. I was excited.
I think, now you can, without feeling like an imposter, you can buy the Signal to Noise leggings and wear them with pride. Wow.
Oh, well, there's Signal to Noise leggings? What?
There's leggings. And when they went up in the store, Jeff Hawley sent me a text and he said, I want those leggings bad.
Yes, there are. I was creating the merch store a couple months ago or whatever. And like, you know, one of the options when there was leggings, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going to make leggings. Why not? So yeah, there are. Yes. Go to our merch store, buy a sticker, buy some leggings, whatever suits your fancy.
And shout out to Erica Rust, who we had on the show. She got the leggings for her birthday, I think. And
Do you have gentleman size leggings?
It's a Chris question.
I will have to get back to you on that one.
They are Lycra, and everything is gentleman size and Lycra.
Okay, so one size fits most.
You know what I got Kyle for Christmas? It's a one piece Signal Noise bodysuit with a butt
with the flap. With the poop flap.
Oh, yes. Thank goodness.
Man, so when Warp Tour comes back, Kyle's just going to come to every stop, just running through the audience every day in a one-piece Signal to Noise spandex outfit.
Trying to find the chicken breast and the coolest porta potty and a can of water.